Yeah.
And
they were like sort of little harnesses that were made out of bra straps.
And cameras as well?
Yeah.
And they flew to Key West, Florida?
Exactly, yeah.
Were you aware there's a trade embargo? Were the pigeons?
You know, I didn't get into a very serious political discussion with the pigeons, but I was definitely aware of the trade embargo and with the obviously with the Trading with the Enemy Act, and that was definitely...
So how do you know the pigeons made it to Key West?
Well, there was a loft that they were homed out of, and that's where they returned to with the cigars and,
And their cameras successfully filmed their voyage.
Yeah, well, it was important that as I said, there was 50 pigeons and 25 of them I trained to carry the cigars and 25 to carry these very tiny cameras so that I could, film the process and prove that it actually happened.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry is headed to Cuba right now, and, at least relations are going to begin to be normalized with the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, the flag being raised, the one in Havana we covered just a few weeks ago, the one in Washington, D.C. Your thoughts as an artist who, attempted to break the embargo a little while ago.
I think that... when I was doing the project, I was, mainly concerned more with the fact that I feel that the Trading with the Enemy Act was completely unconstitutional and, it is different than an embargo, actually, because it's the...
We've got 5 seconds.
Yeah, shit. I'm not very good at this.
I want to thank you for being with us, Duke Riley. Did the Trading with the Enemy project, and we'll link to it at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. We want to thank the wonderful people who worked with us here in Venice, Danielle De Giudice and Alberto Arcia and Francesca and Andrea and Peter Uriese. Also, thanks to Mike Burke, Amy Littlefield, John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced in New York by Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
good morning. Thank you, Sly and the Family Stone, for that start to this edition of Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland, and I have in the studio with me a guest named John Daggett. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Paul.
And we're going to be talking about resilience, theory and practice, and talk about John's long background in teaching and school administration and how he got into thinking and teaching about and training in resiliency. So before that, my first order of business is to apologize for some shockingly misinformed statements I made last week in talking about the Shell No protests. This may have just passed right by you, so I may be no need to bring this up. But anyway, I was talking about the Fennec icebreaker and where it was located and what people might have done to further attempt to blockade that ship. And my understanding of where the icebreaker actually was located was amazingly off base, considering the fact that I was actually up there at Cathedral Park and somewhat involved in this. Anyway, I'll just leave it right there. If you heard it and know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. If not, just let it pass by. So, that said, I've got some announcements for events coming up. The Social Movement Action Center will be opening its doors for The Telling Takes Me Home, an exhibition of mixed media works by Kira Loki Anderson, Samantha McPherson, and Bonesaw. Come along on the 13th, that's tomorrow evening, from 6 to 8 p.m. For wine, nibbles, and a talk and question answer about the creative work and archival material on display. The exhibition explores personal and collective narratives of community, belonging, loss, and resistance within the Pacific Northwest Forest Defense Movement. It explores personal and collective narratives of community, belonging, loss, and resistance. I just said that. He'll also be exhibiting some of the Hysteria Collective's archives. The Hysteria Collective was active in the early 2000s in Portland and provided support for survivors of abuse within the punk and anarchist communities. The venue is wheelchair accessible, and that is at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue. That's a new space, the Social Movement Action Center. Also tomorrow at Clinton Street Theater, but you just heard this on the promo from the KBOO. It's a KBOO event. The Yes Men Are Revolting. On a recent day, a hot day in New York City, Shell oil reps scooped up free snow cones shaved from the ice of the last Arctic icebergs to celebrate their launch of the Arctic drilling rig. After folks spat out the icy treats in outrage, it was revealed that, yes, this is yet another Yes Men prank. In the new film, Yes Men Are Revolting, prepare to be stunned at what the Yes Men accomplished with a giant polar bear costume, a marching band, fake microphones made from pipe cleaners, thrift store suits, etc., etc. Again, that's at the Clinton Street Theater tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Southeast 26 in Clinton. Friday from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Musicians Union Local 99. That's at Northeast 20th and Sandy. The announcement of Bernie Sanders' candidacy for 2016 Democratic presidential nomination raises a host of questions for the U.S. political left. Can an independent candidate maintain integrity within the two-party system? Can the Democratic Party be reformed from within? Is socialism a viable political alternative? You are invited to join the International Socialist Organization and Socialist Alternative for an evening of debate and discussion featuring Chris Zimmerly Beck of International Socialist Organization, Melissa Volono of Socialist Alternative, and Nick Caleb, independent candidate for city council. Again, that's at the Musicians Union Local, Friday evening, 7 o'clock at Northeast 20th and Sandy. Sunday at 10 a.m. At Triumph Coffee, a new coffee house at 201 Southeast 12th. This is, I don't actually have the title. I must have cut that off. Anyway, one in five people struggle with a mental illness, often in silence. What if the person struggling was your brother, your friend, your neighbor, or your coworker? Would you want to help? Did you know that you could? Everyone is invited to join us in a conversation-based workshop discussing issues surrounding mental health and suicide prevention, includes self-care tips and a training on spotting warning signs of struggle to help your family, friends, coworkers, and community. You also receive a certified training in suicide prevention called QPR, stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer. It's presented by Live Again, which is a 501c3 nonprofit all about starting healthy conversations that strengthen communities, increase wellness, and reduce suicides. Again, that's Triumph Coffee, 201 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland, this Sunday at 10 a.m. Two quick last things. Center for Intercultural Organizing, another event tomorrow at 6:30. Critical Resistance's Portland chapter is seeking new members to help build up their prison industrial complex abolitionist movement and chapter here in Portland. Join them Thursday, August 13th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Center for Intercultural Organizing at 700 North Killingsworth in Portland for an informal info session. And you can go to their website, just look up Critical Organizing. And Steve read this earlier, this Saturday at noon at Pioneer Square, people will gather to show support for the historic Iran nuclear agreement reached several weeks ago between Iran and UN Security Council's five permanent members. Noon this Saturday at Pioneer Square, sponsored by a number of local organizations. So with that out of the way, let's get to our show. So John, talk about this concept of resiliency. What do you mean by that?
Well, I define it as an individual or a group that's able to bounce back from adversity, not only stronger, but with new learnings. And also, maybe even more important, if the components are fully in place, a person is or a group is less likely to even experience adversity. Mm-hmm. We can't wipe out all problems and all that, but we can mitigate them greatly when we focus on these preventative factors.
And so resiliency can be at various levels. It can be both within an individual and it can be within groups as well.
Yes, and the concepts that support an individual necessitate working in groups. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, of course, we're going to get into greater in depth as to like what led you to think about this, who's been writing, researching, talking about resiliency. It's obviously not a new concept. I mean, just anybody talking about psychology in general, it obviously comes into play because it's the ability of the individual to deal with not just adversity, trauma, et cetera, to get over it into...
That's true. About 30 years ago, it really wasn't the case that it was very much in vogue. I think psychology was in a labeling business and then a fixing business. And one of the reasons I was interested in it as a school person is that if we try and attack every problem individually, we're not looking at the systemic causes of them, and we don't have the energy. If we can get on the other side of it and see what we can do to be preventative, we're very much ahead.
Well, you mentioned teaching, and now that we've sort of introduced the idea briefly, so talk about your own experience. You had a long, long career as a teacher, and then you got into teaching administration. Talk a little bit about your own history.
Oh, I started teaching in the late 60s and then was a school administrator in about 15 years running a small school district. So I guess I couldn't keep a job. I kept moving from one thing to another. Probably the most fun was playing with fourth grade kids and seeing their eyes light up.
But where did you teach?
I taught in Beaverton. Mm-hmm. I taught in, after retiring, I taught in at the University of Washington and Lewis and Clark. I also taught in Europe for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. But your longest stint was in Ashland, is that?
Yeah, as superintendent there, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And was it in Ashland or was it before you got into this, more specifically in this concept of resiliency?
Really, the topic was just coming out in the early 90s with the book written by Emmy Warner and Ruth Smith from the island of Kauai. They followed 700 babies born in 1955 and followed them for 40 years. And I like research, especially longitudinal research. It's hard to do good research on humans because the controls can be painful and all that stuff. So longitudinal research really is enlightening. And the assumption was that about 250 of the 700 children would not make it in the world because they were from deprived homes, parent in jail, alcoholism, abuse, etc. And then the results were not the same when they looked 40 years out. And Emmy Werner and Ruth Smith said, well, what's causing that? And they kind of were the groundbreakers in this idea that, gee, we can overcome things. And so that's, I read that book, got interested, and then...
And what was the name of that book?
Overcoming the Odds by Werner and Smith. And then Henderson and Milstein wrote a book about building resiliency in schools. And I went to their workshop and liked it. And then I challenged them. I called them up and I said, what if I was smart enough to be able to build a resilient school system in a community that didn't understand what that was? And so they partnered with me and we worked together in the whole community to get the vocabulary down and the understanding and the underpinnings and the idea of, you know, where we were going. Well, so that's my background.
Yeah,
guess,
well, let's get more into that. But again, so the people you partner with, Henderson, what are their names? Henderson and...
It was Mike Henderson, and then it was Annie Henry. His original book was written by a resiliency lady called Henderson, but Henry was his partner. And anyway, they came to town, and we got together with the stakeholders in the community and
but where were they located?
At that time, University of New Mexico.
Uh-huh. And so they came all the way to Ashland because had anybody approached them with such an idea before?
No, I guess that brought them out of the school and into the community. It kind of broke them loose.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they were basically academics, researchers.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
And they're still doing this work in New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
They've moved there in their retirement.
And so the first book, Overcoming the Odds, was a longitudinal study of children starting from a young age, I take it.
From birth.
And the second, about resiliency in the schools, they studied children in schools.
Right, and there had been more research done after that.
Uh-huh.
So they were
following up on that original work.
And they ended up with six components that we can go into later.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can go into those six components right now if you want, and then jump back into, you know, kind of go back and forth sort of from the theory to the practice and back again, as it were.
Okay. Werner and Smith's main finding was that if the people that really struggled and that overcame and actually outperformed the intact families, they had someone that truly cared and supported them. And that doesn't mean enabling, but that means always there, believing in and giving good guidance. So that's probably the most important. I think the second factor that's difficult in our society now is having clear and consistent boundaries. I know parents struggle with this with all the pressures from other parents about letting kids do things that may be not appropriate. There was a recent example in the paper a few days ago about the poor kids that are excelling and they're not getting enough sleep. And so I don't think they're getting enough care and support at home, and I don't think that they've been taught appropriate boundaries. If children have lost an hour to 2 hours of sleep over the last two decades, that's going to affect their health, obesity rates, suicide, and all that stuff. So anyway, boundaries is a very, very important thing. And when establishing boundaries in a group, it's wonderful. They're more effective if the people involved in those boundaries help define them. The third component is setting and communicating high expectations. And there's just abundant research over the last 50 years about the impact of high expectations. The old classic study is the teachers are brought in at the beginning of the school year and they're told, this one teacher is brought into the principal's office, hey, you know, we've selected these really smart kids for you this year and we expect them to just really boom and they're going to do well. And the other teachers aren't talked to, so this teacher leaves and they're very, oh, this is neat. And lo and behold, at the end of the school year, the kids just outperform everybody else and they're thought so highly of. And they were just randomly selected kids. There was nothing special about them. But it's that notion of expectation of self and others that's more powerful than we believe. The fourth one is meaningful participation. And that's incredibly important. Viktor Frankl talked about that, participating, doing, bonding with people, and being appreciated for what you do, and then contributing is all important. Another one is pro-social bonding and connectedness. Now, we have kids, a lot of kids right now, unfortunately, bond, but they bond in gangs, and that's bonding, but it's antisocial bonding. So, you know, clubs and things like that are very important. And we can get into the power of bonding as we go talk about some examples. And I think the last skill, the number six one, is kind of being a lifelong learner, communicating better, money management, being up with the times, so that you can deal with what's coming at you. So those are the six components, and they don't have to be learned separately. And a lot of times, one activity encompasses them all. So, but these are the theoretical kind of construct of resiliency.
Well, I haven't yet said that this is a talk show, so you are invited to call in, and the number is 503-231-8187. We have a caller, but let's hold off, Sean, for just a second to give us a chance to spin this out just a little bit more. So we talked about a little bit about the origin of the school of thought with these particular researchers. We've talked about your own background. So you said you worked with these people to try to talk about that project in Ashland. You're the superintendent of the Ashland School District, and you're obviously interested in resiliency through your reading, but also as a teacher. Obviously, it sort of naturally leads you to think about, you know, dealing with kids all the time. And you wanted to sort of put into practice these ideas. Talk about how that went.
Well, it was the beginning stages of these ideas, and, you know, we stumbled along and did what we could. We had a group called BARC, Building Resilient Community. We would meet with various members of the town and talk about healthy happenings. At one time, a high school junior came into my office after we had a bond approved and thought we ought to spend the money on a skateboard park. And I explained to him that the bond was committed for other reasons, but that we ought to have a skateboard park. And so I had him get together with the park and recreation director and Rotary, and the community raised the resources, and the students helped design and build the skateboard park. That's a classic example of resiliency in action, because people are solving their own problems and they're empowered and they tend to take care of what they work on.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, your discussion of the participation in the context of schools and learning. But let's go to our first caller. Sean, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A couple years back, Amy Goodman interviewed Gabor Mate. I believe he's a child psychologist. And there was a line that just really stuck with me. He said that children, in order to have just a chance, and this is just a chance to have healthy brain development, must have an emotionally available and unstressed adult in their lives. And that just really blew me away, especially in the context of a relentless class war. 20 years ago, Noam Chomsky gave a lecture called Class War, the Attack on Working People. And he documented very clearly how crime pays in this country when government and big business team up together to not enforce labor laws and to basically destroy the quality of life of millions and millions of people. And so when we're talking about the lives of children, Cornel West and Sylvia Ann Hewlett had an amazing book called The War Against Parents. And so I guess I was hoping your guest might comment on how do you have resiliency when your population has basically been targeted in a criminal class war, and how do you manage resiliency in that context of just being under constant attack, constant devastation, when we've been targeted for orderly disposal, essentially. So if you could riff on that, thanks.
Well, I think that's a very complicated question and obviously a very good one. And I don't know that I have the answer, but let me just throw out some thoughts on this. I think you need to work in small communities locally. I don't think we can rely on big brother, big government to help us, as you've so eloquently just stated, they can undermine us. So being aware of what brings health is really important, and then working with others in talking about these ideas. And I think also this is a tough one, and it may offend some people. We've got to start taking responsibility for our actions and not blame other people or society, and want to be responsible. And then turn these ideas over to your subconscious so that the subconscious is working 24/7 for you, so that they're going to be more evident in your life. And then look at what's called protective factors that you already have in your life. That would be someone that does care about you. That would be your energy, your creative impulses, all the positive things you have. And look at how you yourself have overcome a difficulty and learned from it, and find joy in that, and get local friends to work with you. A simple-minded idea, but that's all I can offer you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It brings up the idea that we talked about when we first met. I talk a lot about doom and gloom on this program. The really shocking state of affairs that we find ourselves in at this late stage of a capitalist undermining and disintegration of personal psychology, community, and the ecology, all at the same time, triple or even greater threat that we're facing, which is kind of what the caller was alluding to, at least part of it, that we're under constant attack. And so I brought up the idea, well, how, you know, don't we have to, isn't resistance immediately implicated in resilience? Aren't we, you know, don't we have to resist the onslaught at the same time as we are, birthing this, these better social relations, healthier social relations? We are being more resilient in the face of this. And yeah, it's a twin aspect, at least. Anyway, I was going to read this thing about resistance and resilience, which are both ecological concepts, but I think I'll leave that towards the end. And let's get to our second caller. George, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul. I had a question for your guest and you, but your first caller just absolutely put it so much better than I could have. I was going to put it like this. If we are being targeted in some ways, becoming unwilling participants in the activities of criminal gangs like big business and the FBI, the CIA, the military, torturing people to death and so on, and making their lives miserable, bombing infants and children and mothers in a couple of countries now, and maybe other places, and hundreds of CIA operations over the years. How are we on earth can we going to resist that? But then you, Paul, just picked up the other part of the what I was going to ask about was, don't we have to resist? And you did it perfectly, and this is a great topic, and I'll just hang up. I'm fascinated. I want to listen to this whole program. Then I want to come over to KBOO, and I have something, a part of a book that I want to hand you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for calling.
You bet. Bye.
I think you're talking about boundaries when you resist. And if an organization, a corporation, a government, an individual attacks what you have established as a boundary, you need to resist. That's part of your obligation as a human. And if we don't, we succumb to it, and we're in deep trouble. We can even die from it. So this isn't a totally passive thing, but it doesn't mean you have to resist with violence. You just say, no, I won't participate. You know, we've been driven by faulty research to do some public policies that are very antithetical to the goals of the policy. Joanne Harry's book, The Scream, The First and Last Days of the Drug Wars, is a classic example of how we've created the problem that we're trying to solve. We've used punishment for drugs in this country for the last decade. The war on drugs is now almost a $1 trillion business.
And several decades, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Long, long, long time. And her research, just recently out, 2015 book, debunks the notion that it is the chemical that's hijacking the brain, and debunks the notion that addicts are there because of their moral failings. And in all of her research, one of the main things was that we based this notion of chemical dependency on a single rat in a cage being offered heroin water or water. And the rat in the cage chose the heroin water and, quote, became addicted. Well, they looked at it and said, let's change this environment. Maybe that's unfair. So they gave a bunch of rats rat heaven, mazes, food, and also heroin water and water. And lo and behold, very few of them messed with the heroin water.
And when was that original experiment done, do you recall?
Gosh, I think it's about 30 years ago. It's when we started the war on drugs.
Right.
And it's a mantra. And it is really, really wrong. And what we're doing in prisons by putting someone in solitary confinement, as Amy Goodman just talked about in the previous hour, you are absolutely stressing the person and making them want to protect themselves with some kind of a drug. And so if we built resilient communities...
Or breaking them down is basically what it does, yeah.
Yeah. Look at the country of Portugal, and they had 1% of their population totally addicted, and they were using our model of the war on drugs. And somebody in leadership said, you know, this isn't working. Let's try the opposite, which is almost always a fascinating idea to do. So they used all the resources they were spending to incarcerate and punish and torture people that were on drugs, to provide care and support, a place to participate, give them loans, to build businesses and things. And they cut, with a very short time, they cut the dependency on drugs 50%. That's astounding. But it's resiliency doesn't fit our current mode of education or control, because it's not authoritarian. It's collaborative. And I think it's nature's way. Buckminster Fuller talked about the notion of being synergetic. And human beings by nature are. The sum is greater. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. If you take the biped human after he evolved to being a biped and he loses a leg and doesn't have support, he's going to die. But the lone wolf on four legs can lose a leg and survive. So when we became bipedal, we started to work together. And I think we need to go back to our natural roots and work together to solve our problems and not give the problem over to daddy or big government or anybody else, but work together in communities and support one another.
I'd like to, this is Paul Rowland with the Wednesday Talk Radio, and my guest is John Daggett. We're talking about resilience or resiliency, and he has had a long, long career as a teacher, a school administrator, and more recently doing teaching and training specifically on this concept of and practice of resiliency. And you know that and the number to call is 231-8187, 503-231-8187. We do have three lines open. If you have never called before, if this is a subject that interests you, if you're a teacher or just a community member who's interested in this, please give us a call and join this conversation. We're gonna be talking about what people can do to put this information into action as well. So, you know, you mentioned that experiment with the rat, and we kind of just quickly went over that. Let's just repropose that. I believe the previous caller talked about Gabor Mate. I believe he talked about this very same thing in his work as well, in the show with Amy Goodman a couple years ago. So the original research was done 30, 40 years ago, and it was seemingly designed to bring about the result that it did, to reinforce this idea of the moral failing or the inherent failure of the rat or the human being in the rat race, so to speak. So they gave they put the rat in this stark environment, and they basically didn't they what they starved them or didn't give them any?
In the part I remember, they had a choice. They could drink heroin water or regular water. And I think the conclusion after the subsequent research was that the stark environment was stressful. And when people cannot connect or bond, this is one of the fundamentals of resiliency. A lone rat in a cage, like a lone human being in a cage, cannot connect with another human being. And so they salve their pain by a drug or whatever. And that's what they're bonding to. They're bonding to the drug instead of another human being. That's found with people that are addicted to gambling. They're bonded to the addiction of gambling. It's the same kind of bonding. It's just an unhealthy kind of bonding.
And these things are, as we all know, are difficult to break out of. We all have our addictions, I believe. We all have our unhealthy dependencies. I think because we all live in this unhealthy society.
Let me talk about old research that doesn't fit the new paradigm. And I say the new paradigm meaning we have to be accountable. It's an accounting metaphor instead of a more biological metaphor. This was research done in the 30s by Jennings and Nathan. And they studied 60 high schools, 30 in the control and 30 not. Again, longitudinal work. And it certainly doesn't fit the paradigm of today. The experimental group was challenged to increase degrees of freedom within their high school as much as possible. And the colleges that the students would have normally gone to said, no worries, we'll accept you. So they didn't have to worry about, you know, any test scores or anything. And just to sum it up very quickly, the most collaborative where you had olders teaching youngers, people working together, you know, the greater the degree of freedom, the more experimental the school was, the higher achieving. And by the way, both did the same in terms of effectiveness initially in college. So there wasn't a downside to this increasing of degrees of freedom of the experimental group. What I thought was interesting was that one of the schools was, I think, Ohio State University Lab School. And those folks decided to survey themselves after 30 or 40 years. And even though all of these students got the same basic college education, a little bit better for the ones that were in the experimental group, the long-term life health of those students was far greater than the norm. There was greater happiness at work, more stable families, people were feeling success. And so it tells me again that when you empower people to be part of the decision-making, setting goals, learning what their passion is, and working in teams, that kind of stuff has much more long-term effects.
Well, let's go to another caller. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Tom Sincik. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I work in the school health centers here in Multnomah County for 25 years. I've been working with kids for 40 years. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I wanted to kind of add a piece of something that this is the kind of work I've done with working with youth in the clinics I've worked in. But I want to throw out something. Colin and Alma Powell began a group called America's Promise Alliance. And it kind of focused on these ideas, and it was basically five promises for youth: caring adults, safe places, effective education, a healthy start, an opportunity to serve. So that, and they found out that if kids had three of these five, their chances of having a bad outcome down the line really got reduced. And they started this in Harlem, and it really relates to the stuff that you're talking about. And so I guess that's just kind of throwing that as a framework that communities can use in terms of building resiliency as such an important item. So I really appreciate that, and I want to put a plug in. A previous caller talked about what do you do with these kids that are families have been decimated by the criminal justice system. I had 3 years of work in corrections health. And I work with many kids whose parents were absent, incarcerated, gone, dead. And if you bring in some of these things of resiliency, there is hope to get these kids by if you bring the right kind of collaborative community working all together like it's been talked about.
So let me, I'll turn this over to John in a second, but so do you have, you know, I'm going to go in a, you know, practical direction here. Do you have any specific projects in the Portland area that you can suggest? Do you have any ideas for, you know, directions people can go to plug in to pursue these ideas?
Well, I'm very clinically oriented in my work, but mm-hmm. I think the opportunity of making schools a framework of getting kids involved in what's called the coordinated school health system, the after school programs for kids, get them plugged in. There's a lot of schools that have these the after school programs throughout the city, and so that is a place. If you've got kids, get them. Well, you said that. Get involved with sports or writing. There's a group I really know of in town that's growing. It's called AC Portland. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they do work with kind of sport and poetry or academics or math, and it's just growing over the last few years in Portland, and people with kids or people that know people with kids could find out if in their community. They started out in North Portland, but I know they have some programs now in Southeast Portland as well. As one example, I really don't have any direct connection to that program, but I really like the kind of work they're doing with kids in terms of building resiliency and collaborative work.
The caller maybe knows about this. Peter Benson did some work in the 90s, and he used what he called asset model. And in resiliency jargon, I'd call it protective factors. And he made a list of 24, he called them assets, that
right.
if students had them, how would they do in life? And I broke them into the six categories, and don't have time to go into in detail now, but let's consider 24 healthy things like family support, parental standards, wanting high achievement, assertiveness skills, being involved in bonding activities that are healthy. When a student had 30, between 26 and 30, they 51% of those students were A students. If they had 0 to 10, only 5% were successful in school. If they had 26 to 30, in terms of volunteering, 75% of those students volunteered, where the national average is 37% of the kids. Vehicle recklessness. If a student had 26 to 30 of these protective factors in their life, their chance of getting in an accident was 19%, where it was almost 80% for the kids that had 0 to 10 of these protective factors. I could go on and all the list of that. There were 650 students between the age of sixth grade and graduate from high school that were surveyed, and the results were just astounding. So if we focus on these six elements and see that they're embedded in families and school classrooms and in individuals, we have a healthy society, and we have less need to solve all these problems that are devastating us.
So we're trying in the school-based clinics. It's very difficult and clinically. I want you to work more with taking care of the sore throat or whatever. But assets building has been a key part of at least what I've tried to always focus on, and I think that is hopefully the direction that school health centers are going is, you know, do it. That's where your prevention is. If you want to prevent problems, you have to build for kids. You have to build assets.
Absolutely.
And I would add that they've actually taken this research down to now first grade. You can actually see the sort of the assets for first to third grade, and you know, down to the younger age, and comes out of the Search Institute is a site that you can go to. Just look up Search Institute, and it'll list all of this stuff. yep. that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's Peter Benson's site, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. I will link to all these things on the page for this at kboo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. And caller, if you know, if you feel like sharing any more detailed information, I always give out my KBOO email address, Paul R. KBOO, KBOO, Paul R. KBOO at gmail.com. And I thank you so much for calling. And
thank you so much for the show. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, yeah. And we want to link people to information, projects, sources, and help people get connected up. That's what we're trying to do here. And my guest is John Daggett, and he is talking about resilience based upon his long experience as a teacher, school administrator, and doing his own research and work and teaching in the field of resiliency, which is kind of a, I guess it's a sort of a field in and of itself in a sense, now that there's a body of research that talks about what it is and researched it, and is people trying to put resilience in into practice. And I, you know, I had mentioned when we were talking before the show about this thing called resiliency circles, which I don't know. I know I talked to one person in Portland who was involved in it. There's groups throughout the country. They're basically groups of people. Mostly, the best way to do it is people in a physical proximity to each other, so it's easier to meet. You know, you can meet more informally on a regular basis. People get together, have dinners, and can do study groups, can do particular projects, whatever it is in your community. And the idea is to build that kind of mutual aid and resiliency within communities, neighborhoods. And if anybody is involved in that in Portland, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. I know that's one area where people are putting into practice these ideas. So let's go to our next caller. Natano, you're on the air.
Hi there. Interesting show. You mentioned Gabor Mate. He talks about proximal abandonment. And Daniel Goldman has this emotional IQ test. And just curious, is there any efforts to try to test kids for emotional IQ so you can catch those that are really lagging behind? Because it turns out that emotional IQ is much more important than your regular IQ for overall success in life. And I was just wondering if a proximal abandonment might have something to do with low emotional IQs.
I think you're above my pay grade. that you're getting areas of psychology that I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't want to say something that I don't know about.
You've been talking about it. It's basically having stressed out parents who are there physically, but they're a million miles away emotionally, and that's what.
Well, I think it's healthy care and support. I think that's the key. Somebody that will spank your butt when you get out of line, or keep you from crossing the road and get run over by a truck because they really care about you, as opposed to just being your friend. Care and support is that deep belief that the person has that they know that you care for them and will look out for them and be their friend.
And obviously, you know, what we're talking about, you know, necessitates a wider support to the extent that we're able to do it. Because obviously, if, you know, a parent or friend or whoever is not able to give that support because of whatever reason, because they didn't get it in their life, you know, it becomes these vicious circles. And that's what we're trapped in, because we have a vicious economic system that fundamentally doesn't care and doesn't give support. And so continually creates, situations in which people, especially people of color and, people who are marginalized, we can get into all the issues that are covered on KBOO and Democracy Now! All the time that are continuing this process. So, you know, we need, you know, to somehow create broader networks of support and resilience in order to repair this damage and, you know, gradually raise children that don't have, that are not, don't suffer these same things. Anyway, thank you so much for calling.
The working class is really subjected to a lot of economic violence, obviously, and that's what you guys are talking about.
But, for sure.
That really translates into, you know, pressure at home, and then you take it out on the persons around you, and yeah, it's definitely a huge problem. But thanks for the show.
All right.
Yeah, this caller wanted to know some details about what happened in the community I worked in Ashland, and we didn't do pre and post testing or anything. What we had was a community group of folks that met and talked about these ideas and were consciously supporting resiliency activities for kids where they could participate in healthy activities. For example, that skateboard park I talked about. And it was bringing to consciousness level, to the conscious level of the parents and the leadership that I wanted to do. And for a while, when everybody was on the same page, we were making policy decisions at the city level and even at the college level. They were involved in this, and at the school district, that supported these six concepts. I wish I could be more, delineate, how effective it was, but I retired and some things carried on and some things didn't. We started a charter school. We called it the Wilderness Charter School. And in order to survive, a young person would have to have all six components. They would go out in the cold Sierras and in the Calamiopsis Mountains and spend 30 days out there with a teacher. And so they really learned practically how to function. These were kids that didn't like the normal school, and so they learned their reading, writing, mathematics, what was called the natural resource strand at that time. It's now changed.
Well, let's go to another caller. Vernon, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about the contrast between competitive sports programs and collaborative band programs. When I was in school, a lot of kids would choose one route or the other. There'd be the kids on the football field banging their heads against each other and the kids in the bleachers playing music together. I'm curious whether there's ever been any studies on the long-term effects of that choice and whether one or the other is a more beneficial path.
Well, we do know the long-term effects of brain damage. We know that from football. But actually, in all sports, they have to obey rules, because if you don't obey rules or boundaries, you can't have a game. And they do learn to work together, too, as you do in a band. And so there are maybe more similarities than we like to think about. But I agree, a lot of sports, especially football, are pretty violent.
Well, I think, and Vernon, you bring up an interesting question, which is kind of, you know, because people do put forward sort of the sports model as being sort of this model of teamwork and working together as sort of the bedrock of, you know, social learning, social skills, and sort of the bedrock of social stability and all that. You know, I heard something on NPR the other day, a football coach, I think, extolling the virtues of football exactly for those reasons, which, you know, you hear about quite a bit in our culture. And, you know, and as far as it goes, that's true. You know, I grew up playing soccer, and I loved, you know, team sports, and I'm sure I did learn some things there. But there's a deeper level that you're talking about, which is the agonistic approach versus a more cooperative, non-competitive approach, which is a really interesting thing to bring up and not really talked about very much.
Yeah, the difference between your team going out and beating the other team as opposed to going to a joint orchestral camp where you all play music together. I mean, there's no enemy in music.
No, I think it'd be, you know, if you find some research, if you'd like to do that, take that task on to find some research on that, I'd love to talk about it on the show. I think that's what's great about doing this live radio is you kind of get to put things out. And I would really like to establish more of sort of a cooperative research project here on KBOO through this show and others to, you know, to involve people in the community to sort of take on different parts of this research and whatever that we need to do to continue this. So I thank you for calling. And please,
thank you.
Yeah, please call in again. And again, my email address is paulrkboo@gmail.com. And coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 in a few minutes on Political Perspectives Radio, EcoShock host Alex Smith is interviewed about this long, hot summer of 2015 and climate change. And thank everybody listening to KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you are not a current member, you can always become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today and be a part of this resilience network. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting subject. How do we build resilience here at KBOO? You know, resilience, like in institutions, it's a really interesting topic because institutions tend to, you know, develop these mechanisms to perpetuate themselves, and there's sort of good aspects and not so good aspects within that. And that's another deep question, but we've only got 3.5 minutes left. So I'd like to give you some time to say your other thoughts before we close here.
Well, one thing I didn't mention, but it's to me, it's a positive view for the future when the former president or past president of the American Psychological Association, Martin Seligman, he just finished a book in 2011 called Flourish. And he wants us to move from focusing on post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic growth, and helping psychologists learn how to take that experience, that trauma, learn from it and be stronger for it rather than be so damaged by it. And it's very real, but sometimes we make things worse by, I know one case, a fellow was going to counseling and he really didn't want to not be labeled that because he wouldn't get his government stipend. So maybe we need to change the payoff. It shouldn't be for having it, but being paid for getting rid of that that disorder. Instead of, because if you're motivated to have a lifestyle,
that would be a paradigm shift,
wouldn't that be? And we might do the same with schools. Let's pay for success instead of seats in classrooms and things like that.
So many avenues opened up here, and I know we don't really have time to answer this question, but at least sort of an initial answer to how can individuals and groups put this information into action?
Okay. I think that's one of the things I started with, but let me just review. It's taking personal responsibility. It's understanding that we have the abilities, and knowing what the research is telling us, getting someone to care about you, care about them, volunteer, work with other people, take responsibility, just that kind of stuff. Expand these ideas, make them personal, make them yours. Work with others.
Okay, and I just got the indication that it's about time to wrap up here. We got a minute left. I've been speaking with John Daggett about resiliency, and I believe we're going to do this again, I think would be a good thing at some point.
Okay.
Maybe not immediately, but Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for more great programming.
There's a cross for you to bear. Things to go through if you're going anywhere. Things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal. Stand.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City